welcome to another stunning edition. Well, we hope stunning edition. I'm totally unprepared. I'm Dave Champion. This is my co-host, Bill Carnes, and together we are totally unprepared. All right, in the first thing, we always talk about things that are in the news.
This is a good one.
It is a good one. There is a gal out of California.
Imagine.
Who is suing a British company and the author of the guy who wrote 50 Shades of Grey, which, as we know, has been turned into a movie that's soon to be out.
Did a guy write that?
A guy wrote that.
I don't know.
James, this is his last name.
I thought it was Jane.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So a gal is suing this British company and him. Now, the British company makes sex toys? Is that what we would sexual accessories?
I think they would refer to it more vanilla as marital aids.
Marital aids, all right, that works for me. And one of them is I think the correct terminology is a personal lubricant.
Yes, the 50 Shades of Grey.
Yes.
Personal lubricant, which I don't know if that's a take on the title or if it actually comes in 50 different shades of gray for different purposes, I don't know.
Well, she bought this one called like Super Alive or something like that, which is sanctioned by the guy who wrote 50.
So he gets a piece of the action.
Yes, he's put his name on it and he gets some money. And the British company, I think it's Lovejoy or something, which is a
50 levels of
Lovejoy.
Lubricant.
Isn't that great? That is a British name, but a company that makes, what would you call it, marital aids?
Marital aids.
Lovejoy. Yeah. Okay, that all works together. So this gal is suing this company because she purchased this like Super Alive sexual lubricant, which on the package it says it's going to provide enhanced orgasms. Okay. Now,
I buy that.
Yeah, right. But, and then apparently there's some quotes from the book which I'm not going to, that are on the packaging, which I'm not going to read on the show. Something about, you know, explosive orgasms, right? So she buys this product, and you want to guess why she's suing the company?
Let me guess. She didn't experience the TNT?
Yes, yes. This thing that she's supposed to have enhanced orgasms, apparently she didn't.
Wow.
Right. Now a couple of things come to mind. First of all, to go online to buy personal lubricant and actually buy into that is nonsensical.
She might have bought it at her local retail center.
She could have done that too, right?
Yeah.
Walked into, you know, one of those sex shops and,
but I mean, Walmart might sell it. Who knows?
I mean, that would be like picking up this water and saying, "Oh, it's going to make me smarter or better looking," and believing it, right?
You know, it's funny you say that. I know somebody that used to market oxygenated water.
Yes,
and I'm like, oxygenated water is. It's
water.
No, it's
H2O.
What is that you pour on a cut? Not alcohol.
Hydrogen peroxide. Right, right.
It's H2O2. Oxygen. You can't. Anyhow.
Which anybody who's got a hydrogen peroxide in their mouth knows you don't want to.
Yeah, you don't
want to
drink that stuff.
So anyway, this gal files this lawsuit as a class action suit, right? So damages could be substantial.
So there's got to be at least three or four other people that are claiming the same thing.
No, the way class actions work is if you can get a judge to buy off on the fact that you represent the class, then the judge certifies it as a class action. So the class that she's asserting is anybody who's purchased this product in the last 4 years. But the other thing is, aside from the fact that, of course, this would be like I said, I'm going to be better looking or more intelligent because I drank this water, the absurdity of that she's going to have enhanced orgasms by...
Was there maybe an asterisk?
I gotta love that.
Was there perhaps
thank you.
In here? Was there perhaps an asterisk next to enhanced orgasms compared to if you've been living the last 4 years in the woods and haven't had any other contact with anybody and there's been nothing but bark and dirt on the ground? I mean, is then it enhanced if you use this? I mean, was there? And here's the other thing that kind of
how
bothers
do you measure
me about
this?
It's got to be. A qualification of, do you believe what this woman says? Because what else do? You hook yourself up to all kind of monitoring devices and have a video camera going and then compare before and after?
Maybe you give her a spin, I'll give her a spin, we'll vote.
I don't know. Because if she's suing like this, she's probably not altogether up in the head.
No, I got to tell you.
I mean, come on. That's like suing Wendy's back in the 80s. Somebody fought a lawsuit against Wendy's and it was thrown out because there's no ham in their hamburger. Can you believe that?
Well, this is like to file the suit is to pretty much come out publicly and say I didn't get off like I wanted to.
Yeah.
Now, by the way, what I was laughing about over there is our engineer very kindly put a note up for me that the author of the book is E.L. James, who is a female. I didn't know that.
Oh, okay. Good.
Yeah,
look
so
at that.
James is not Guy. James' last name. It's a female. I don't follow these kind of things.
I understand the movie's supposed to be coming out, so my girlfriend told me that.
Gray that's going to happen in my world is I don't need to go to the theater for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, my girlfriend said that that's supposed to be coming out soon. I don't know. They don't.
You're going to be spending some money, clearly.
I don't know. I'm not the demographic that they would market that book or the movie to.
No, you're not female.
No, so.
I don't know any guy who's read it.
Do they talk about things like donkey punches and Blumpkins and things? I don't know. I have no idea what this whole 50 Shades of Grey is all about.
Oh, it's we've talked about, not in reference to the movie, but you and I have talked about this generically.
We have?
Well, yes.
Where was I?
It's light BDSM.
Oh, okay. I don't remember that conversation, but.
Let me remind you of this.
Oh, no. Because if I didn't remember it, there might be a reason I don't remember it.
Yeah, probably neither one of us would.
Like, yeah.
All right, so you had something you want to talk about.
I did, actually. There's a story that's come out of North Carolina recently. And this story was initially billed. There was a guy from North Carolina who shot three guys who happened to be Muslim. And the initial breaking story, the way that it came out, really shows the
headline.
Yeah, it really shows the way news is. They want to get information out there as fast as they can, which means they can't really investigate.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you really fluff this up to where people are watching your news channel or reading your news blog or whatever it is, more so than somebody else? You sensationalize it.
Right.
So it was initially sensationalized with the idea of it is a right-wing conservative Christian Muslim hater redneck. They just gunned down these three Muslims.
Right.
As it turns out, that isn't the case at all.
There's only one part of that whole story that's accurate. Gunned down three Muslims.
Yeah.
Yeah.
However, that has nothing to do with it. It was an argument in a parking lot over a parking space.
Long-term argument, by the way.
This had been going on.
Yeah.
And the three who got shot were Muslim. The guy who shot them, he is progressive, left-leaning, atheist who likes Southern Poverty Law Center and a couple of these ultra left-wing newscasters. If you go on his Facebook page, you read his posts, you look at his likes, this guy is anything but conservative or Christian. Yeah.
By the way, he's
neither of the two.
For those of you who don't know, when Bill says the Southern Poverty Law Center, the message that you can or should take from that, the Southern Poverty Law Center is they're communist.
Really, they are. Yeah.
And so if you're like anywhere from middle of the road to the right, and you're somebody of notoriety who has a voice, Southern Poverty Law Center will have you on their list of like what right-wing, reactionary, violent extremists.
Yeah.
And bizarrely, the United States government uses the Southern Poverty Law Center's information to put together their list of potential terrorists in the United States.
Yeah. It's a really leftist, very scuzzy, and if you look at what they do and how they do it, some of the money that exchanges hand, they're a very dirty organization.
Yeah, and
almost as bad as the government itself, how dirty they are.
Yeah. So this guy, the shooter, had liked the Southern Poverty Law Center, and yet they're calling him a right-wing extremist.
Yes, he's. If you look at some of his some of the rants he's got on his Facebook page, I wouldn't say rants, but some of the attention that he pays, some of the things that he writes, a lot of the likes, the people, the organization, such as that. He is very left-leaning, which brings up another topic. We, right now in Aurora, Colorado, the judge is interviewing potential jurors for the movie theater shooting that happened a few years ago. If you want to look at all of these people that have gotten away with these various mass shootings, if you will, and mass shootings to the federal government.
Three or more.
Three or more. So that's where this one in North Carolina just hit the minimum. If you look at the people who perpetrated these acts, they all share very common traits. Virtually all of them share the following. One, they have some mental instability, and they are on or have recently just come off of, on their own volition, psychotropic drugs.
Right.
That's
yes,
a number
absolutely.
One. And the second one that seems to be very, very odd, you wouldn't think that this happens, but this seems to be the way it is, just historically speaking. They're all very leftist, progressive, raised and existing people.
The phrase that leaps to mind when you describe them is self-permissive.
Sure.
That's how I see leftists, self-permissive.
Yeah.
And, you know, what you were talking about with the drugs, I believe it was Joe Rogan. Joe Rogan?
Joe Rogan. Okay. Yeah, he's funny.
who said something, and I'm paraphrasing him. In America, we have a drug problem masquerading as a mass shooting problem. Okay? Because virtually all of them, I think, there's two exceptions. When you look at like 37 cases, there's two exceptions where they were not on the psychotropic drugs you're talking about.
So we're talking 2 out of 37. We're talking 94% of the people are, a little more than about 95% of the people are, 5% are not. So if you want to look to stop these things, you don't, the gun itself is not the problem. It's the idea of banning guns and restricting guns to stop mass shootings is the same mental analogy as banning vehicles to stop and curb DUI.
Yeah.
I mean, let's ban cars. Let people drink and do all this, and then let's ban cars, because it's a behavioral issue.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes, behavioral issues with alcohol are manifested in other areas. And now we see a lot of these psychotropic drugs that people have been on have manifested themselves in these violent outbursts, and oftentimes to very detrimental scenarios with these mass shootings. And the same answer always comes around. How do you stop these mass shootings? And Dave, we've talked about this ad nauseum. That's right. An armed citizen.
I'm not pointing to what you made me think. I'm pointing to.
He's got a 1911. He's carrying appendix carry and a holster. And what it comes down to is an armed citizen who's there at the time that this happens pulls out their guns and they stop him.
Yeah.
That's the only way to do it.
On I think it was December 2012 on the Dave Champion Show, I did what I call the big gun control show, where I debunked all these arguments. And I said, there's approximately 185 million gun owners in the United States. And over like the last 30 years, I think there's been something like 37 mass shootings in 30 years. Okay. So I'm like, okay, you've got over 30 years, 37 of these incidences, 185 million gun owners. And then I did the math on what percentage, and it was like 0.0000068. And that just illustrates that it's such a tiny.
You are far
crazy.
You're over 1,000 times more likely to be killed by your doctor due to medical negligence than by getting shot in some sort of an aggressive, violent crime.
Yeah.
Stay tuned, folks. We're going to be back with What's Up With This with Dave and what my rants are right after these words.
We are back, and now it's time for What Is Up With The Incredibly Poor Performance of Doctors, of Medical Doctors. Now, I'm going to start by talking about something, the personal experience of mine going back 13 years or so ago, and then I want to move fast forward into a very personal experience that happened to a friend of mine here recently, to lay the foundation that we have a systemic problem with incredibly poor doctoring. Now, notice I'm not condemning nurses. I'm not condemning medical personnel generally. This is all about the MDs. And, of course, I'm not condemning all MDs because, like any profession, there are those who excel, and then we have that big group who isn't excelling. Now, my personal story is about 12 or 13 years ago, I became out of the blue. I had lived a healthy life. I was constantly, back then I used to do a lot of running, a lot of cardio. I was in the gym 6-7 days a week. I was the picture of health. I was robust. I had a great career. A couple of them as met. Life was going great. I couldn't have been happier. And all of a sudden, one day, I started feeling ill. And when I started feeling ill, I weighed about 220 pounds. Within about 10 months, I weighed 310 pounds and hadn't changed anything I was doing. It was as if, in addition to the various, I mean, I could go on and on and about all of the consequences and symptoms, but I'm not. But one of those that was most telling, it was as if somebody had slit open my abdomen, put a volleyball in there, and then stitched it back up. I mean, that's how hard it was. To tap my stomach was like tapping this table. That's how hard it felt. And this weight was just piling up on me, and I couldn't bend over and tie my own shoelaces. If I had to go to a business appointment, I had to have one of the kids tie my shoes in the morning so that I could go. If I had lace up, you know, dress shoes with a business suit, I had to have that laced up for me so I could go on to my business appointment. I could buy new suits, but what do you do if you can't reach your feet, right? And this went on for 2 years, and the doctors never, I think a critical point, in 2 years, the doctors never did determine what was wrong with me. When my primary care physician went on vacation, another doctor looked at my file and said, I don't mean to be alarmist. He had spent about 20 minutes reading through my file. He said, I don't mean to be alarmist, but I think if we don't find out what's really wrong with you, there's a chance that you could die. And sitting there after, I'm probably about 18 months into this at that time, thinking, yeah, I pretty much agree since my body is a complete and utter wreck over something that no one can identify. Another example, during that same illness, my primary care physician sent me to two specialists in the same field. They are both in the book, The 500 Best Doctors in America. So in theory, these guys really, they're the 500 best, they really know their stuff, right? And they're in the same area of specialty. And he sent me with identical prescriptions to the two different guys. And they came back to my primary care physician with diametrically opposed diagnoses. Okay? Best guys in the nation. 180 degrees opposed to what was wrong with me. And eventually, Western medicine never did heal me. What happened is, in sort of desperation, because I really had never had much confidence or faith, really what I had was no knowledge, and hence no confidence or faith in holistic medicine. So I, out of desperation, at about the 2 year mark, I went to a holistic doctor, and within about 6 months, I was probably 95% well and back to being the way I needed to be. And that speaks to how little the medical profession knew. Now, we can jump forward to have things improved from 13, 14 years ago. Well, a friend of mine recently, he was telling me that he had this burning sensation in his chest. And he was telling me he had been to two doctors. He went to his regular MD in town. And now this is a guy, here's the profile. Mid-50s, never does a lick of exercise. Will tell you, will admit at the drop of a hat he has a very stressful life, right? What's the profile we're getting here, right? And he says his chest is burning and his arms have been aching, okay? I'm sure every single one of you watching this knows exactly what you would suggest might be the problem. Well, the first doctor he went to see sent him home claiming it was heartburn. 4 days later, he went to another doctor because it was so bad, he couldn't tolerate it. He could barely get up out of a chair and do anything. What are these symptoms of, right? I mean, I didn't go to medical profession, and I know what I'd be looking for. And the second doctor, this is day four of this scenario, the second doctor sent him home telling him it was heartburn. Do you want to guess what happened on day five? Yeah, massive heart attack. Now, thankfully, fortunately, he is still with us today. Just saw him earlier today walking around. His color looks good. He's great. And now that they've determined what the problem is, of course, they're taking the requisite steps, at least as they understand them, to return him to health. But all this should have never happened, right? They should have seen this coming a long way off. And for two guys over a four-day period to send him home claiming it's heartburn when he had 100% blockage and all those particulars I just shared with you is absolutely absurd. And my real concern, my question is, Bill, when we go to seek the assistance of these people who are supposed to be professionals, and so many Americans, as you know, they just lay their healthcare in the hands of somebody else. They're not really personally involved except as far as following what they're told. So, Bill, how can we have confidence when we go and see these guys?
We really can't, Dave. You know, my primary care physician is a naturopathic doctor who actually went to medical school is licensed in the state of Washington. There is no licensing for that in Nevada. She's actually working to become licensed in that. As a matter of fact, there are a few different levels of certificates that you can get within that field. She holds the highest certificate available from the most prestigious organization.
Other than from medical school.
Exactly. Well, but she went to medical school.
Right, right. But the certificates you're talking about are more from the holistic
side.
Yes,
exactly.
Okay.
So she's a practicing nutritional physician. And holds the highest rating that you can get in that, is working to get that certified in Nevada the way it is in Washington and a couple other states. And I go to her because she is not prostituted by the pharmaceutical companies. I mean, the last thing the pharmaceutical companies cured was polio. And since then, they're like, you know what, we make a whole ass ton of money more by giving you quality of life and keeping you on the drugs. I mean, what do HIV patients take? Like $10,000 a month worth of drug cocktails? Well, if you were cured, then that's 120 grand a year times however many people have it that they don't get.
Right.
So I'm with you. As a matter of fact,
they're not curing patients, they're making customers.
They are. Yes, they are. Clients, you'd almost think, with that kind of money. My father, he's going to be 78 years old later. He's 77 and a half now. Mm-hmm. And he's in the top 1 percentile for both physical fitness and general health in his classification. Wow. As 77 and a half year old male. He goes to the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale a couple times a year for checkups. They've actually saved his life on a couple of occasions. He eats well. He works out 3 times a week. He's in great shape. And it's kind of interesting the way that this works out, because he was having some issues. And at Mayo, they referred him to somebody here in Las Vegas, or where he lives, like here in Las Vegas, where he lives in Las Vegas, to go and do a bunch of tests. Something like $15,000, $16,000, $17,000 worth of battery worth of tests later, the doctor said, well, I can't really see anything wrong. Let's do this again in another 6 months. Well, of course, he was through the roof on that. Took all of this stuff, took all of those rights, said, I'm not paying you another dime. Give me everything. Took it down the mail. They looked at it and said, well, some of the x-rays and some of the things you've got are poor quality, but I can see right here and here we've had 2 small strokes, and here's a 3rd one that's coming, and probably within another 3 weeks you're going to have it right here.
Wow.
Then they diagnosed the reason he was having them and fixed him. Okay? But that's Mayo Clinic, and not everybody can get in there, not everybody can afford it. My dad got in years ago. He's kind of grandfathered in, for sake of a better term, because he's 77 and a half. Great grandfathered in. But anyhow, it's difficult to trust this. You and I know somebody who graduated nursing school just this last year, who certainly had some trials and tribulations, especially during the 3rd year of the 3-year program.
Because he thought some of the stuff was absolutely nonsensical.
Absolutely.
And he's brilliant in his own right, leaving aside the nursing school.
And you and I know somebody mm-hmm. who just started his 3rd year in medical school.
We do.
And his, for lack of a better term, nearly wife, I mean, they've been together forever. She is not only practicing nurse, she's actually finishing up her last year to become a physician's assistant. The amount of time and energy that is put on these folks to have this schooling and have this career, basically the female in this scenario is working full-time and going to school full-time in an effort to get through this physician's assistant certification. And then he is dedicated to about 85 or 90 hours a week.
Wow.
Between doing his rotations at the hospital, 3 12-hour shifts, plus full-time school. Then you've got all the studying and the testing that goes on at home, including some things online. And they wonder why we don't have more people getting into the medical profession.
Right.
Well, if that's what you're doing in year 3, it should be a 4-year program. That's too much.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes I wonder, too. You remember the old adage about the police academy, right? You get out of the police academy, you go day 1 on patrol, you sit down in the car with your FTO, and what does he say to you?
They say, forget everything you ever learned about the academy. I'm going to teach you all about that.
Right. Right? Now we're going to teach you how it really works.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And I believe that's true, not of the technical stuff. But there's so many protocols and procedures, and if X, you must do Y, which obviously break down and fail. We just had some examples of that I cited. It seems to me like they're investing so much time in these detailed protocols and procedures and perhaps levels of knowledge that they're great on test, Did you study? We're going to find out if you studied. But then when you get out and you're taught, you're like really going, breathe for me, you know. It's a lot of that is irrelevant to what you do day in and day out. And they're not teaching these guys, it seems to me, I'm not an expert. I'm a layperson looking from the outside. But it seems a lot of what they're teaching these guys is not what they need to know to actually do the job.
That certainly would seem to hold water. You know, the latest statistics are better than they used to be. But the latest statistics are about 200,000 people per year are killed due to medical negligence. 200,000 people. That's 4,000 people per state.
They want to take our guns.
Every year.
Take our doctors.
Yeah. going to the doctor and dying due to medical negligence has an incredible percentage of fatalities in there. I mean, just the sheer numbers, 200,000 people per year. Yeah. And it used to be worse. Ralph Nader's group back in the 70s and 80s said it was upwards of 300,000. And now we've got a higher, so it's better, but still, that's a huge number.
Yeah. All right, so when we get back from the break, it's going to be time to launch into your segment.
What grinds my gears.
Which will be fascinating. So please do stay with us. We'll be back right after this break. Don't go away.
Welcome back from the break, and now it's time for you know what really grinds my gears? When people, artists, professionals, will sing the national anthem their way, not our way. I really take issue with that. We don't restate the Pledge of Allegiance with different verbiage or different punctuations or accents on it. And I don't think that we should ought to do that to try to personalize the national anthem. If you ask any professional singer who's ever had the opportunity to sing the national anthem, they'll tell you it's very, very difficult to sing. A lot of lows, a lot of highs, a lot of really punching it out there. In fact, probably the very best rendition I have ever heard was about 8, 9, 10 years ago when Carrie Underwood sang it for the Super Bowl. I think it was Super Bowl 40. And just an amazing rendition. As a matter of fact, I have a copy of it. Leanne Rimes did a rendition maybe about 20 years ago, which was just unbelievable. Faith Hill, again, fantastic. When you get these singers that get out there and they use different tempos, or they throw out maybe a different phrasing of it, something along that line, to try to show their singing prowess. I got to tell you, if you're being asked to sing at a major event and you're qualified to do it, you've already demonstrated your prowess to make it through this. You don't have to really abort the history and the feeling and really just the pride behind the national anthem by trying to individualize it and make it your own. Stick to history. Stick to the way it was designed to be sung, because a lot of people love to sing it along with you. And when you start screwing with it and making it your own, it's no longer ours. You make it yours. And it's not about you. It's about all of us. Dave, what do you think? And the reason I bring this up was because of the way it was sung at the most recent national anthem. The performer in there decided to do it on their own.
Oh, I'm with you 100%. There's nothing that irks me more.
Grinds your gears?
Grinds my gears. Then somebody singing the national anthem and, you know, they suddenly like lunge out with these crazy notes, you know, that aren't traditionally historically there. They're trying to hit these highs or bring them down. Now, here's why I think this goes on, by the way. By the way, I agree with you. They shouldn't do it. But here's why I think they do it. You're probably aware the national anthem, as far as vocal ability, is one of the most challenging songs to perform.
Sure.
To do it in the traditional historical way that people tend to like, it requires a lot of range and a lot of power. And it fluctuates between high intense output and not. It's vocally challenging. And so I think the people that are willing to accept that challenge, sometimes they're the kind of people who want to not just meet the challenge, they want to show that they can go beyond that challenge, that they're even better than that. And you're an artist yourself, to an extent.
Artiste.
Yes, I'm sorry, an artiste.
I used to be a musician many years ago.
Which is to what I'm referring. So you understand there's that sense of creativity that you say, well, this is good, but let me put my own little twist on it.
And there's a time and a place for it.
That's the deal.
And the national anthem is sacred enough in my book.
Okay.
It is neither the time nor the place ever at any time.
Yeah.
At any place for any reason. And that, it's kind of the holy grail well, it's a national anthem. It's the holy grail of all patriotic songs.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to take, something about the fruited plains and you want to, you know, get colorful with that, I'm not exactly excited about it, but it's not as sacred in my book as a patriot to the national anthem. Now, keep in mind, I love my country. Doesn't mean that I love my government. As a matter of fact, I recently put a post on my personal Facebook page about something the government was doing that was ridiculous, and that I love my country, but I don't trust and at times detest my government for some of the things that they do. That has nothing to do with the national anthem.
It's a different story.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it's interesting. If you do a little history on the national anthem, we're only singing the first portion of three of the original poems.
Yeah.
So there's actually a lot more to it if you went into it, but
you know, a funny story for you.
Just keep it straight when you sing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is, too, there's an expectation level on the part of the people that are listening. And I would say if we were to take a poll, the very large lion's share of the people want to hear it as they know it. It's that kind of environment, that kind of setting, very traditional.
You know what's interesting, too, is the people who sing it properly, I've oftentimes seen them invited to other events to sing it again. But I cannot think of a single time where anybody has taken the national anthem, made it their own and made it all colorful, and ever been invited back or to another event to sing it again. I've never actually seen that. So I guess if you want to have a hit it and quit it on singing the national anthem in front of a large group, television audience or a big sporting group, screw it up. Make it your own and forget about tradition and you know, that'll be your one
or
time. You never have to do it again.
Make it your own and do it well and people still probably won't want you back.
Yeah.
You're a few years younger than me, so I don't know if you remember this, because it happened when I was a boy. Robert Goulet, you know the name.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Very famous singer back in the day. And known to have a few cocktails, starting shortly after he got out of bed. And he acted...
Bear the dog.
And I believe, if I remember correctly, a Canadian, at a, I think it was a World Series game, forgot the words.
To the national anthem?
In the middle.
To the Canadian national anthem?
No, of the U.S. national anthem while singing it.
There's many a times that's happened.
Didn't Christina Aguilera have an issue a couple of years ago?
I don't know.
Some screwed up somehow?
I don't know.
But funny story.
I mean, I love her talent and ability, but I don't follow her enough to know if that happened.
No. Yeah. Funny story. True story. I think it was down in Texas. They were at a football game, baseball game, something, and they play the national anthem, right? I'm sorry. They didn't play the national anthem. The song they played first was the Lee Greenwood song, God Bless the USA.
Okay, right? Sure.
So this one guy is sitting in his seat, minding his own business while God Bless the USA by Lee Greenwood is playing. And these two drunk schmucks behind him, they're like, stand up. Pardon me? They're like, stand up.
What, because the USA was in the song? It was now to need to...
And he's like, why would I stand up? And they're like, because this song is playing. He's like, this is not the national... First of all, I don't think you should have to stand for the national anthem if you don't want to. Part of being a free country, right? But I would certainly understand the drunk schmuck's perspective more if it was a national anthem. But these guys, these redneck drunk idiots were demanding that he stand. And they actually turned around and slapped him in his head.
America.
Yeah,
America. America. USA.
Get on your feet.
For America. Was that us?
Yeah.
Was that us? Because, I mean, we're doing it pretty good right now. It could have been us. I don't remember if we were drunk.
That's Lee Greenwood. Stand up, son.
We could have blacked out after that one. I don't know. Get up, son.
Yeah. So, there was something I was going to say, and then because I'm old, it went right out of my mind.
Well, you know, that'll happen. So I hear. I don't know. Yeah, I haven't experienced it.
But let me assure you.
I used to be the announcer at a racetrack up in northern Nevada, and it was a dirt track. We used to have, you know, stock cars every other Saturday night, And I got to tell you, of all of the announcing or anything in front of a microphone sort of thing I've ever done, I haven't ever enjoyed anything as much as that. Live action races going around. I know the vast majority of the drivers. It was in a small town, so I knew the vast majority of the sponsors that sponsored the cars. So I had a depth of knowledge with these guys. I had a lot of music playing with it and everything. And
so let me see if I get this right. If it was a driver you really disliked, you'd like get on the microphone and distract him by like, I had sex with your wife last week.
I guess I could have. However, it's pretty loud down on the track. But no, it was a bunch of really good people, a nice tight community. And it was a Rattlesnake Raceway up in Fallon, Nevada, just a little quarter mile dirt oval. And I always had a great time with that. And I used to regularly get the very best renditions of the national anthem I could possibly find. And those were the ones that I would alternate through and play. Mm-hmm. And I would never even consider one that went off even a little bit. I remember hearing one time that Whitney Houston had done back in the mid-90s or early 90s. And a beautiful voice, obviously very talented. And before really the whole Bobby Brown-isms caught up with her and the talent started to wane a bit, I remember seeing her in concert maybe in 98 or 99. It was incredibly disappointed. It was basically sitting on a stool doing a lounge act in front of 15,000 people at the MGM Grand Garden in Las Vegas. Mm. Very disappointing. Anyhow, but this rendition was excellent up to one point where she made it her own.
Ah.
Never played it. That is, it's a sacred song to me. The national anthem is a sacred song. I remember, oh gosh, we're probably about 10, 12 years ago. It was prior to 9/11, so more than 15 years ago now then. There was an interview that a woman had because Congress was thinking about possibly adopting a different song to be the national anthem as opposed to the one we've got.
Lee Greenwood's song?
It may have been, yeah. And I forget what song they were going to be considering, but what they did was they invited this woman to come in and sing the national anthem because they knew it was more difficult to sing. And I remember this woman in this interview was saying that she'd never been more nervous in her life. She'd be singing her entire life, very, very professional. And she wasn't like a pop singer or something. This is a woman that had more like operatic sort of training and really a huge ability. And she said she'd never been more intimidated in her life than singing to this big session of these lawmakers in Washington, D.C. to make sure that she got it right. And when she was done, she said she nailed it. So, conversation over.
And I would have the different perspective. If I was singing it for a bunch of regular, ordinary citizens, I would feel obligated to do the very best that I could do, just so their ears wouldn't bleed, given my vocal stylings. But if I was performing it for a bunch of politicians, I'd slaughter that son of a...
Well, you gotta realize, it was a bunch of politicians that were considering the idea of maybe adopting a different national anthem.
Right.
Who knows? It might have mimicked the old Soviet national anthem at this point, as far
what
as we've gone.
The Soviet national anthem?
Oh, it's a really big sounding symphonic thing. I don't really know the name of it, but I know it when I hear it, and it's pretty impressive. It is.
You
very
know,
impressive.
Soviet era martial music with all the male singing. It was very rousing. You know, it sounded great.
Yeah, it was almost like a modernized Gregorian chant, which is pretty interesting. You know, if you want to find something that's very interesting, Dave, during the Civil War, you have the United States, you have the Confederate States as well. Confederate States, they had their own constitution. They also had their own national anthem.
Ooh.
And it wasn't Dixie. And you can pull it up. You can actually, there's...
Is that Georgia by Ray Charles?
No. However, that is a Georgia State song now.
Yes, it is.
But... Yeah. You can actually go on YouTube and pull up Confederate States of America National Anthem.
Ooh, I want to do
that. And there's some different renditions of it that you can hear in there. It's basically you're just staring at something while you're listening to the
music.
Is
the Jefferson Davis version thing?
It might be the Jefferson Davis version of the Confederate States of America. Yeah.
All right, good topic, Bill.
Yeah.
All right, so stay with us. When we get back, we're going to respond to your emails, what you'd like Bill and I to discuss. Don't go away. All right, we are back, and this is segment four, where we discuss things that you have written us and said that you would like us to discuss. By the way, you can send us emails at, you want to put our little thingy, there we go. Okay.
DaveandBillShow@gmail.com.
There you go.
Yeah.
And
please send them in. We love getting your emails. Occasionally we get books.
Yeah.
Try to shorten it up a little bit.
Yeah, if it's like eight paragraphs, you can pretty much be assured we're not going to read it.
We'll skim through it.
Yeah.
But yeah.
All right, so viewer Roxanne posed a unique, very unique question, and Bill and I discussed whether we, in fact, wanted to discuss it because it was so unusual. Normally, if it's like, oh, yeah, that catches our fancy, we'll do it, or we just toss it out, that's dumb, we're not going to talk about that. This one was so unique that we kicked it around today, whether we wanted to cover it. And here was the question. Roxanne wanted Bill and I to talk about the relationships that each of us has with our mother. And that you can imagine a show like this, that's an unusual request. But yeah, I think it was the unusual nature of it is why we decided to run with it. And so I'm going to go ahead and start. Now, I'm in an awkward position, and this wouldn't be something I would choose to talk about on a television show. And frankly, I've never talked about it publicly before. You know, there's certain things that you don't get to choose concerning birth. You don't get to choose, for instance, your skin color or your eye color. And, of course, hand in glove with that. Right.
Or
along.
Your lack of hair color.
Oh, yes, in my case. Hey, I have eyebrows. So the other thing you don't get to choose is your parents. And some people do wonderful. The lottery pays off for them, and they get amazing parents. And the way the universe works, you know, the pendulum swings both ways, and I got the other end of the pendulum. So I don't have a lot to say that would be positive. But by the same token, I'm in the unenviable position that is considered, you know, damn right un-American to sit and say bad things about your mom, so I'm also not going to do that either. But I will say that there wasn't much of a relationship. Let me rephrase that. There is. I mean, you're growing up, you're 5, you're 6, you're 8, you're 9. You have a relationship with your mom, but it doesn't mean that it's a good relationship. And it doesn't mean that the person who was impregnated and carried you and spit you out, it doesn't mean that that person is a good person. It just means that that's the person you got stuck with. So I decided what I was going to do rather than sit here and reminisce in sort of what I imagine would be a very sort of unappealing discussion. I thought I would tell a few quick stories about my mom, and I think people can take away the message without me having, these are true stories rather than.
Well, I think you certainly set the groundwork here.
Yeah.
And you've shared some of the stories with me. You've shared the history with me.
Yes.
So yeah, I don't envy how you had to grow up with that, and even into some of your adulthood, some of the things that happened.
Well, most of these stories are from my adulthood. The kid thing is really unpleasant, and I don't want to...
Sure.
This is supposed to be entertaining. I don't want to have people... So, all right. I'm guessing I was probably in my early 30s. I was doing a number of different occupations, professions at that point in my life. And I lived about 45 minutes away from where my mom lived, and I just happened to be down there on a business appointment, and I was driving in my car, and for those who are familiar with like the Sherman Oaks, Encino area of the San Fernando Valley, the Mains Rag, which was even sung about in a couple songs, is Ventura Boulevard. Okay, and so I'm driving along Ventura. My mom had a very noticeable car with the paint job.
A one-off.
It wasn't quite one-off, but they were rare.
Okay.
And my mom also had this gigantic bouffant hairdo thing that she did, right? She was like, you know, living in the 80s with her hair in the 50s kind of thing. And so I'm driving down Ventura Boulevard, and I look ahead of me over in the right-hand lane, and there's my mom. You know, there's that car with that unique paint job and the big bouffant hair. There's no question as to who it is. And so as I'm watching, a bus comes along. This is like rush hour. Okay, on Ventura Boulevard, which was built, I don't know, like in the 30s, so it's not meant to handle modern
horse
traffic anyway.
Horse and carriage almost, horse and buggy.
So as I'm watching, my mom realizes, apparently, that there is a driveway right here that she wants to go in. So she stands on the brakes so that she can slow down instantly so she can get into that driveway. And there's a city bus behind her. And he has no choice but to stand on his brakes. And I'm kind of at a 45-degree angle looking at the whole thing go down. And in rush hour, people were standing in the bus, right? I see these people just go flying and disappear. Oh, it was ugly.
It had to be like people getting thrown down home plate lines.
Yeah. You know, I felt really bad for the people on the bus. The bus driver, to his credit, did not hit my mom's car. So, I don't know, maybe 10 days later, something like that. I was down in that area and I had for business and I had some extra time, so I thought I would swing by and see my mom. So we're sitting there in the living room chit-chatting, and I said, you know, by the way, there was something I wanted to mention to you, and I relate the story similarly to how I just related it to you. And I said, you know, perhaps go around the block and come at it again, because I would hate to see you get rear-ended at your age. That could be problematic. I'd hate to see you get hurt. I suspect some of the people on the bus got hurt, okay? Bad scene all around, okay? I just want to let you know, okay, there's probably a better way to handle that. You know, I knew who my mom was, so I'm trying to soft pedal this,
sure,
right? And she looks at me with this. Now, she knows that she was there. She knows the story is true. She knows at that time on that day she was there at that location. And okay. And she looks at me, and she gets this look on her face like a four-year-old child you would just slap for no reason, right? And she says, why are you lying to me? I think that story illustrates my mother's personality.
Really?
Yes. Then was another occasion. I was there again. I was, again, 45 minutes away. I was often down there for business. I lived in a rural area. This was more of an urban setting. Mm-hmm. So I was down there for business a lot. And I had, again, I had some time. So I stopped in just to say hi, see how she's doing. She's older, you know, want to make sure she's doing okay. She says, by the way, I'm so glad you're not, mind you, I'm in a suit. I'm on my way to a business appointment. And she says, oh, by the way, I'm so glad you're here. I need some boxes down out of the garage, up in the rafters of the garage.
What?
Right. This is my mom. And I said, okay, but I can't do that today. As you see, I'm dressed for a business appointment. And if I go up in those rafters, I'm going to be just decimated with dust. I'll be in such a condition I cannot go to my business appointment. And that's obviously what I'm down here for. And she says, well, I need them down for tomorrow. I said, that's great. Doesn't change my equation in the least. In like 20 minutes, I have a business appointment to be to, and I can't be covered in dust from me crawling around up in the attic. So it's not going to happen, at least by me. You've got Calvin across the street. You've got Christopher a couple houses down. But give them a call. They'll be happy to come over and give you a hand.
What a horrible son.
Oh, and then some. things go south, so I'm like, okay, time to go. As I'm walking down, there's a sidewalk that went from our porch down to the actual sidewalk. As I'm walking down, she's leaning out, screaming at the top of her lungs, what a horrible human being I am.
Okay. All over some dusty boxes in the attic. And your attitude about it. I got to tell you, give me your hand. Give me your hand.
Yes.
Bad son.
Yeah.
Bad son.
Last quick story.
We got just so much time and my mother to talk about, too.
Go. You go.
Okay.
I think they have the gist, so we're good.
All right, so my mother pretty much rocks. She's great. I had an opposite end. As a matter of fact,
you got the other end of the pendulum.
I did. I got the other end of the pendulum. My mother had three kids by the time she was 22 years old.
Huh?
I'm the youngest.
All right.
Of three. And so
she stopped when she got a perfect.
That's what my father says, actually. It's kind of funny. It's nice to hear. Yeah, I must be your favorite. Well, I'm just kidding. No, I'm not. Anyhow, so but my mom, she's actually a stay-at-home mom. My dad had a business. Actually, growing up, he owned, I don't know, two or three different businesses over the years, always upgrading and moving on and doing other things. Always took care of us financially, brought home the bacon. My mom certainly whipped it up in a pan. She was very good. Always there. I was in Cub Scouts, Weebelows, Boy Scouts, all that stuff. I played sports. Several years of basketball, baseball, soccer, everything. Every season there was any kind of sports going on, I was doing it. I was going on camp out. She was always there to help out. And I got to tell you, and one of the interesting things about my mom, there used to be a group of us in high school. I grew up in Las Vegas. A group of us in high school. And
this is where we got the name delinquent from, was this group?
Yeah, pretty much. But one of our friends, he used to have this uncanny ability to always catch us with the exact same joke at the time where we're not perceiving that he's getting us with the same joke. And he'd just pop up with, hey, man, how's Joe doing? Joe who? Joe Mama,
oh,
mother effer.
Lord,
you know, right?
And
he was always doing that. And it's like, Noah, he's, oh, man. Well, unfortunately, Noah didn't make it to the end of high school. He passed away actually when I was a college freshman. I actually got out of high school a year early. He was a couple years behind me. The rest of my friends, we'd been in the same class.
So you dropped out.
They were seniors.
No, I'm kidding.
No, I was going to school in North, but Anyhow, Noah didn't make it past his, even through his junior year. But anyhow, in honor of him, we kind of adopted my mother as Joe Mama, because she was always so cool. Keep in mind, we're high school kids. I've got a little Toyota pickup truck. Everybody'd pile in the back of that. I was always a designated driver, it seemed, because I had the car that would fit all my friends in it. And it was really cool, because during the summertime and things like that, we'd want to go out and go cutting up. My mom always made it a very welcome place for the group of us in the house. We lived about a mile from the grocery store. We'd be out doing something in the middle of the day. We'd come piling in, and we would just raid the walk-in pantry, right? And my mom, she'd grab her purse and her glass. She goes, you know, carry on, boys. I'll be back in just a little bit. She'd run up to the grocery store, buy us all kinds of snack food, sodas, junk food, whatever we wanted to eat. And because she knew if we were hanging out at my house, we weren't outside, right, out on the streets of Las Vegas getting in trouble and doing things we shouldn't be. And she'd allow us to cut up to a certain extent. If we started getting a little, she'd...
A little sideways?
She'd give us that look. Yeah. But she'd let us, you know, we'd go outside and grill. We had a pool. We'd be hanging out by the pool, you know, cranking up our music, but not too loud because we did have neighbors. She was very, very cool with all of that. And she's still that great. She's up in Oregon now. Her husband, now her and my father got a divorce 20-something years ago, almost 25 years ago or so. But she's up in Oregon. He's going to retire in about 6 or 7 months. They just recently bought a fifth wheel RV, and they're going to start making their home base around Nevada, probably northern Nevada-ish.
Oh, wow.
And do a little bit of traveling and see. You know, like my oldest daughter lives in...
So I might get to meet her at some point.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So she's pretty cool. She's a good mom. Yeah.
Awesome.
So good stuff.
I'm glad you had that experience.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
Always nice. Ah, well, that was emotional. My friends, thank you so much for being here. Bill?
I appreciate it. Stay tuned, guys. Send us those emails. We'll be back with you next week.
Bye-bye.